My name is Tim Thomas. I'm 32 years old. Today's date is Wednesday, June 23rd, 2021. We're recording this online, and I'm recording a conversation with my new friend Kirk, and he's my one small step conversation partner.
My name is Kirk Swilly. I'm 62. Today is Wednesday, June 23rd. My recording partner is Tim Thomas, and he is my one step conversation partner.
Well, Kirk, it's a pleasure to be here with you.
Likewise.
First, I'm interested to hear why did you sign up to do this StoryCorps program in this one small step conversation?
At the risk of repeating our previous conversations, I felt it was important to take an opportunity in this time in our country's history to find that safe space to civilly engage with someone who may not share my political, social, or even perhaps ethical views or outlooks on the world, and to try to get to understand you and your motivations as a person, and perhaps share what space I'm coming from.
Yeah, I think for me, Kirk, it was really a kind of a similar or similar situation. I know I live in a pretty small bubble. I don't have a ton of variety in all my different friends that I'm with at work or at home in my personal life. And I think it's always, there's a lot of people out there in the world with a lot of different beliefs and skin colors and et cetera. And I feel like I don't really know the world sometimes. So I felt this was a good opportunity to meet someone and learn more about the world. It's kind of like feels like a plain conversation to me or something, just meeting a stranger and getting to spend some time figuring out who they are for a few minutes. So, yeah.
Cool.
So Kirk, one thing I'm interested about is you mentioned in your bio traveling around a lot and how that affected your views. You said that your views had changed significantly over the course of your life. So I'm curious to hear what where have you been, and like what's changed in your views from all those travels?
Well, it sort of give you some context. I was born and raised in a small Kansas town, El Dorado, Kansas. You know it. You live in Wichita. I live
Yes,
in Wichita.
I drive by El Dorado all the time up to Kansas City. Yeah.
Yeah, when I grew up there, it was it was an hour's drive between El Dorado and Wichita. I mean, the two-lane roads, 55 miles an hour, and it was some distance apart. I mean, the communities have grown together. And as I mentioned in my bio, my father was a World War II infantryman who met my mother after World War II in Paris. And she was a Parisian. He spoke French. She spoke no English. He was from a little town called Toronto, Kansas. And they got married in France, in Paris, and he moved her back to Kansas. And growing up in a small rural town like that, I had a viewpoint that was very, is very tunnel vision. There was one black fella in the entire school. There were two Hispanic kids that I grew up with. And you just really you don't get it. You don't get their culture. You don't They're just Joe Requina and the other people. And I went away to college. I hadn't planned to go to college, to be very honest with you. But I got an opportunity to go to college on a scholarship, and ended up majoring in geology. And I wanted to work for a major oil company, which I eventually did after I got my master's in geology. Went to work for Conoco. And Conoco started shipping me all over the world. And I had been raised in that sort of unicultural viewpoint, but with influence and understanding of what my mother, her culture was, and her influence. What my father had seen, because he was in North Africa, Sicily, Italy, France, Germany, the whole nine yards, all the way to the end. And to start seeing some of those battlefields where he had been, to stand where I knew he had proposed to her. And then, like I said, Conoco started sending me everywhere. I went to Indonesia, Hong Kong, the Middle East. I actually went to Moscow right after the Berlin Wall fell. Norway, the Netherlands. I've been all through Europe. Mm-hmm. I've been in quite a few places in the Middle East, all over North America and things like that. And whenever I'd go there, I made a point, since they were flying me there, business class, by the way, which pretty nice. I used to fly out like 2 or 3 days before and stay 2 or 3 days after so I could learn more about the culture of the place.
Yeah, that's great.
And I really, it expanded my viewpoint. And concurrently going with that was the growth of my faith, because I am a devout Christian. I was a Catholic. I've sort of shied away from that and have joined the Episcopal Church. But with that unidimensional culture that I grew up with that faith, and as I saw these other countries and I met these other people and I learned their other viewpoints, it really started to fold into a much different political and social viewpoint than I had before.
Okay, cool.
So you grew up in Oklahoma, as I understand.
Exactly, yeah.
So what made you, you know, go to Tulsa University? What made you choose your profession?
Good question. Yeah, for me, I grew up in Oklahoma. My parents are both dentists, so that was always something that was maybe an option, but not really what I loved, I wouldn't say. I always loved math and science and anything to do with engineering. When I grew up there, I was always pursuing some of the advanced academics. I actually went to a boarding high school for my last 2 years of high school in Oklahoma City. It's kind of a magnet school for science and math. And then from there, went to university. I always wanted to do, some sort of a engineering type job. And I always loved computers and tinkering with things. And then my career has kind of gone all over the place, right? I graduated from university. Like I said, my wife and I served as Catholic campus missionaries for a number of years. And that was a great experience in leadership, spiritual religious formation. It also provided the opportunity, kind of like we're having today, to just speak to lots of people. The college campus is a really good melting pot of ideas and people, right? For maybe the lack of people that I see today, the variety of people that I see today, I definitely had a good variety when I was on college campuses. Lots of people kind of exploring all kinds of things and really trying to figure out who they are. So a lot of good experience there to see the world and to see other people. And then for the past 5 years now, I've just been working as a software engineer. I like what I do. I think I'm getting a little impatient, maybe ready for a job change at some point in time. I'd like to start my own company or start doing something a little more, where I have a little more, I don't know, control is maybe not the right word, but I can just, let's say, pour more passion into it, right? Something I can find something I'm like really passionate about and pour myself into that. One of my questions, did you get to learn French when you were a kid? Did you get to learn to speak French or no? Did your mom keep that up or no?
No. My mother, of course, spoke fluent French and always did. But at that point in time, they thought the prevalent point of view was that you should not teach two languages to your children. It would confuse them.
Okay.
And so she purposely did not teach me French. I didn't learn that until I did not start speaking French until I was in high school, when my grandparents came over and spent a summer with me. And although they both spoke fluent English, after about 3 days, my grandmother said, "Oh, I'm tired of speaking English so much. It makes my head hurt. So from now on, you need to learn French."
That's great. And that was a good crash course. It's the immersion way that they tout today. So that's great.
Yeah. So anyhow, so I learned a little bit of French. It's really faded over the years. I wish I spoke it more fluently, but I always had a really, really hard time with the vowels and everything. It's very difficult to form the words correctly.
Yeah, it's a tough language for sure.
So,
yeah. And let me ask, so I was just going to go back. I was just thinking about something else too. An interesting part of my story, I hang out with a pretty varied crew in college, especially. Like, some of my best friends were from Saudi Arabia. So I got like a good introduction to, you know, to Islam, but also just to kind of like Arabic culture in general. You know, we did a lot of dinners, a lot of cups where we'd stay up late and cook a bunch of chicken and rice and eat it all together on the floor. So it was fun to get that cultural. And then a number of my other friends are also from China. So our university does have a reasonable international draw. I got to study abroad in China for one of my summers and spend some time with some of my, you know, college friends there in their home, you know, country, and they're, you know, visiting their families and stuff. And I love travel. I love languages too. I'm like always learning, picking up another language, which is probably unnecessary, but I do enjoy it. And I think that contributes to that other culture, the other culture nature of things. But maybe an interesting question for you that I can think of, Kirk, is, what about Christianity, let's say, has like held you close to Christianity after you've seen so many other faiths? I'm assuming you've, like, you know, as you've traveled some, you meet people with these other faiths, or plenty of, I mean, I feel like atheism is fairly prevalent today as well. What about Christianity, let's say, is like, you know, has attracted you or kept you with Christianity?
That's a good question. I do find Islam or monotheism to be quite compelling. Mm-hmm. I believe there is one God, and I do believe in that Christ was the Son of God. Why I still believe in that? Gosh, you know, that's a good question. Sometimes I have a hard time answering that, to be very honest with you.
Yeah. Okay.
But it was so deeply ingrained in me, and the teachings of Christ in the New Testament are so compelling to me in regards to, and you see the commonality across the different religions. I mean, really, you could take the teachings of Christ and they could be a story of Buddha, what he might say, or, the fact that Islam holds Christ as a very important prophet, even though they don't recognize him as a son of God. Mm-hmm. It's always been sort of mystifying to me why people would ever fight over someone else's religious beliefs. You know, why would the Moors invade Spain? Why would the Spanish, decimate the populations of South and Central America like they did, simply over religious beliefs? The fights between Protestants and Catholicism, it mystifies me. You believe in one God. You may have different manifestations on it. I've never understood that, how someone could kill for their God.
Yeah, so. For someone's differing belief in God, let's say, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, on the topic of war in general, which is ironic based on your story, right? Your father and your mother meeting. Yeah, I feel like human war is one of those things that is definitely mystifying is the word you use. I don't know, but maybe frustrating is the word I would use, or kind of confusing. Like, why are we fighting about all this stuff? And I feel like today's climate is a little more tame and mute in some ways. I feel like there is more of a coexist or kind of those mentalities. But I still feel like there's plenty of war rampant in the world, right? You know, I don't think it's not where, well, at least I feel very isolated from it here, where I live and what I, you know, what I focus on. But I feel like it's out there, and it is kind of mystifying, as you're saying, and discouraging. Like I said, I think it's frustrating or discouraging that there's so much war out there.
Yeah, you know, one of the headlines of today that really disturbs me is, you know, after I was a young man, I was in college when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. And as a matter of fact, I was dating a girl who would have been on the 1980s Olympic team in track and field. But the U.S. boycotted the Olympics because it was to be held in Moscow. And so to see us after 20 years leaving Afghanistan, you know, you have to ask yourself, was it worth it? I was in a restaurant last week. This nice young couple comes in with a child, and he's wearing shorts, and he's got the prosthetic leg and a big jagged scar across the back of his head that the hair won't grow. And you wonder, was it worth it? I mean, I certainly understand we were attacked with 9/11, and there were bad people who did that were in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. After 20 years of this, what was it worth it? Mm-hmm. If perhaps, I don't know, we spend trillions on armaments without a question. You know, there's never been anybody really saying, hey, we're spending too much on war in Afghanistan or war in Iraq. But people get really upset when they talk about taking some of that money and giving it to build schools in Iraq or Afghanistan, to build up their infrastructure. And to help those people have a better life. You know, I don't know the answer. Yeah. I really don't. And the older I get, the less sure I am about the answer to anything. It just seems like...
That's an interesting perspective.
It just seems like, for God's sakes, there ought to be a better way to solve something than to bomb the crap out of somebody.
Yeah.
To spend as much time and energy as we are in creating autonomous weapons so we can kill other people. And that's where it really hurts, because when you compare it with our faith, because you're a Christian, we talk about that. Did Jesus really want us to spend as much time in war and things like that as we do, as much as our time, treasure, and talent? That young man who spent those years over there, lost the leg and everything.
I mean, I wonder what the alternative is, right? And I don't think it's necessarily possible to convince America to, like, you know, stand down from all of our military endeavors and to go into a pacifist sort of mode. But I wonder what would happen, right? If we as a whole country were to just say, you know, we're putting our weapons down. We're not going to be pushing and poking anybody. You know, I don't know what would happen, to be honest. But.
I don't think we could. I mean, I really don't think that we could. Somehow the Swiss figured out how to do it. I mean, after all, the Swiss were a fierce people, and they defeated the Austrians to create
their
Republican. The Swiss nation, and then stepped into neutrality. But I don't know. It saddens me. And especially as I think about in Afghanistan right now, all those people who looked at us as liberators, like my mother looked at the American troops when they liberated France, and they worked with the Americans and our allies to help defeat the Taliban, and now we're leaving. and we're leaving them behind. And the bad part is we know we're leaving them behind to certain death. And not just them. They'll kill not only them, they'll kill their parents, they'll kill their children and everything else. It really saddens me, and I don't know the answer. And I find it frustrating, especially in light of my faith.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things that has changed for me over the years. So.
Are your parents still alive? Did I ask this before, Kirk? I don't remember.
No, both of them are deceased now.
Okay, yeah. I can't remember.
Yeah, I assume your parents are still alive. They're probably my age.
Probably younger than me. Probably. Yeah. My mom turned 65 this week, so she's getting older, but not old. Of course not.
Yeah. One thing that I did that I would encourage you as a young man to do is and do it early and often. I have a few recordings of my parents telling their stories, their life stories. And I wrote some of them down. I don't have near enough of them written down. When I retire, I tend to spend a lot of time doing that.
Transcribe them, yeah.
Yeah, do that while they're still alive, because I have a lot of questions for my parents that I can't get answered now.
Yeah, we do one of our habits as a family is we do birthday interviews. So essentially anytime it's someone's birthday, we get out the video camera and like interview them on, you know, mostly just like what's your favorite color type stuff. But we ask them, you know, things that are interesting and try to kind of set the deck a little bit to catch some of the year from what they did or what they learned or where they are, you know? But I started doing it for my parents as well. So I'm just kind of like, you know, force them to, or have them tell some story about some time when they were younger or something, just on the film. So you capture that. I think it's the same as you. It's a good reminder. That's important. And we just went and saw my grandmother here this past month who's 93 now, you know, and she's getting pretty old. And we got to do some of that. I set the phone on record on the table whenever we're eating dinner and started asking her questions about, you know, World War II and other parts, that just to kind of understand, hey, what was your perspective? What did it mean to you to live through that? Right. Because I feel like our World War II in my mind was like a half a century ago, because that's when I learned about it. It was, you know, 50 years ago, but it's like coming up on, it'll pretty soon it'll be gone. It'll be 100 years old, and it'll be something that's like we all forgot about. You know, a lot of people forgot about. There won't be people sitting around telling you what their experience was like, at least from it. So, I think that's a good point.
Good thing to do. Yeah, I wish I had done more of that while my parents were still alive. And the other thing that I did that I found really fascinating was I did the ancestry.com genetic test.
Yeah.
Yeah. And boy, a lot of things that I had thought were true, you know, like my mother's from France, right? So my genetics should be, I'm 50% French, right? No, I'm not 50% French. And I knew that she had mentioned that her grandfather on her mother's side was German. And her mother was French. They lived in Alsace, which is a blended border area. Uh-huh. But where it really got interesting was I had always thought with the last name Swilly that I was Irish, because there's a town called Swilly.
Yeah.
And indeed, I am a little bit Irish, but I'm mainly Scotch and Scandinavian in Northern Germany.
Yeah.
And then what really surprised me, and this one, was it popped up, I'm 3% from Congo and the Cameroon.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah, and both my parents are dead, so I can't ask them how that happened.
Yeah.
I suspect it comes from my mother's side, but then I've got a very uncomfortable question that arises in my mind.
Yeah.
Did my ancestor, who is black, enter into that relationship to give birth to one of my ancestors of their own free will?
Yeah.
Or was it a colonialist in the Congo, which the French were in Congo?
Yeah,
you did, of course. It's a very uncomfortable discussion.
3% is a ways away, though, right? That's at least 3 or 4 or 5 generations back.
Anyways. What to you? And I figured it was it had to be in the 1700s.
Yeah.
That this happened. What's interesting about it too is my father was quite prejudiced. Mm-hmm. My mother wasn't, but my father was very, very, very prejudiced. Yeah. I grew up hearing that a lot.
Yeah.
And it was only after I left that I saw these different cultures that it started dawning on me that, you know, prejudice just really doesn't fit in with my religious views or the reality of what I saw in the world. But I'd love to see my dad's face if I had handed him that
report, yeah,
thing, and said, "Hey, by the way, did you know you married a black gal?" that would be sort of an
interesting boil his problem. Blood a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
What do you think about all this Black Lives Matters and all the like kind of modern, I don't know what you want to call it, sort of racism conversation? What's your take on it?
For me, it was, like I said, I didn't grow up around black people. I had one friend, Kent, who was black, but we never really thought about it.
Yeah. He was just a guy.
I went into college and then started traveling and spending as much time as I did in other cities that really became prevalent. And I remember having a young man work for me, super, super nice guy. And his pride and joy, he had the most beautiful, this beautiful Audi sedan. And he grew up in Compton and took advantage of education, educated himself out of that area. He was actually a rapper and knew the people who started rap. Quincy Jones was apparently a father figure to him. But one day he was late to work and he called me up, and this was when cell phones were a little hard to come by. And he said, "I'm going to be late." I said, "Why is that?" So he goes, "Well, I'm pulled over right now. I was driving back from Oklahoma City. It was Monday morning. And I'm pulled over right now, but I'll be in as soon as I can." And when he came in, he was about 3 hours late. And I was like, "You know, you okay? Or no problems?" He goes, "Yeah, I just got pulled over by the highway patrol." I said, "Oh, okay, you got a speeding ticket." He goes, "No, didn't get a speeding ticket." I said, "Well, what'd you get pulled over for?" He goes, "For driving while I'm black." I go, "Oh, come on. What do you mean?" And he goes, "Oh, yeah, I didn't get a ticket, but I got pulled over because here I am, a young black guy with a shaved head, and he was pretty muscular too, driving a brand new Audi, whatever it was, across the state line from Oklahoma into Kansas." And so we talked for a while, and he started telling me, he goes, "Oh, yeah, I've been stopped for driving while black many times." And he started telling me about growing up in LA. And then as I went through life, this most recent thing is one of my best friends that I was a mentor to is a young black man out in Nashville. And when all this was happening, I called him up and asked him what he thought about it. Mm-hmm. He says, "Well, I'll tell you what, I quit running in the neighborhood I live in." And he lived in the same neighborhood as my nephew who lives out there. Very, very nice neighborhood. Because this young black man is a very successful businessman. We joke about him someday hiring me to be his chauffeur. And he said, "I quit running in my neighborhood." I go, "Well, why?" And he said, "Because I had too many people looking out the windows with a pistol in their hand after the Black Lives Matter. And I was often pushing the baby stroller with my son in it." So, you know, it's hard for me to imagine what they've lived through and what their perspective is. And then when you reconcile it with the fact that I'm 3% African in descent, and who knows how that came about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. From my perspective, I often feel that I think that everybody's overreacting. Maybe that's the way to describe it, right? But again, if you're the one who's experiencing that kind of hate and stuff, then maybe overreacting is not quite the right term, you know. From my perspective, I think there are let's just say people are not so much overreacting, but there's deep misunderstandings on both sides of the issue. You know, I think that from my perspective, at least, there are probably all kinds of systemic issues in you know, police departments or highway patrol, whatever, right? Or, you know, schools or you name it, all these different organizations. I'm sure there's lots of biases that are like sort of embedded in the, you know, in the fabric of those organizations and those systems, right? But at least from my perspective, I'm always discouraged whenever I hear some African American music that I'll hear oftentimes, whether it's rap or whatever, and the message is so very depressing. I mean, it's like a product of the culture in the world that I feel like is so much, whether it's, you know, in the Bronx or Compton or wherever these places are, you know, I feel like there is a really negative and kind of bad culture that exists, you know, so much so that I wouldn't feel comfortable being there in those places a lot of times. And not because of the color of people's skin, but only because of the attitudes and the stuff that I hear coming from those areas, you know, in the same way that I would be, you know, afraid perhaps to be in some places in the Middle East or something, you know, not because I think that, you know, not so much because of skin color, but because of like the perceived understanding I have of certain cultures, you know, and not even cultures on like a super large term. I think for me, the biggest part is that I do feel like I judge people and I have some sort of, you know, prejudice, and maybe it's not the right word, but prejudice against cultures. And I use the word culture really kind of loosely to mean like any sort of the way people live and the worldview that they have and the way they kind of, you know, approach the world. Right. I do have prejudice against sort of worldviews, but not so much skin color. So like there are plenty of people who I know who have black skin or white skin or whatever kind of skin who share a really similar worldview. And like, it's really, they're white collar like me. They're just like, you know, living their kind of their own little life. You know, they have their house, they have their kids, they have their dog, they have their job. And that's kind of their thing. Right. And those people are easy to get along with because they think like me, you know. And the hard thing for me, I think, is when I go to other cultures, and I use that word loosely, like whether it's in the Bronx or somewhere, and there's, you know, rampant theft or crime or whatever, like that bothers me. I don't like being around people that I think are like, you know, sort of crime, you know, tendencies towards crimes and stuff, right? Like, I'll talk to anybody if they're going to, you know, reasonably respectfully talk to me calmly, right? If I don't feel threatened, like they're going to, you know, attack me or, you know, rob me or something, like I'm happy to talk to anybody of any color. But I do think that's what makes this issue so hard from my perspective, is just that I feel like there are lots of serious issues and cultural norms that are established in places. Like I said, you listen to rap or something, oftentimes the message in the song is very scary. I mean, if, like, if anybody was singing, I don't care who you are, whether you're Eminem or whether you're, you know, whoever, right? Like, I don't care about your skin color. You're scaring me with your thoughts, you know, in the way that you're acting. So I don't know. That's my perspective. I feel like the Black Lives Matter is a movement that is, it seems to me, a little misunderstood, but I don't know. And that's why I'm just interested to hear it, because you said that you had some of that kind of African-American and prejudice in your history. So it's interesting for me to try to understand your perspective.
Yeah, it's, you know, and it's sort of one of those things, your life experiences take you in a different direction. I'd say my closest friends, I mean, it's like this young black man, his name is James, by the way. I love James like a son. Mm-hmm. I really do. And he worked for me. We worked together. We did a lot of work together, but there was just something about him that was so compelling. I'm as proud of him and his business accomplishments today as I could have been if I had, you know, provided the genetic material for him. Mm-hmm. I have some other friends who are black who I, you know, there's a lady who I just love like my sister. She's my same age and everything. And mm-hmm. and it, you know, if you had asked me when I was 18 if I would ever have those experiences and those thoughts, I probably wouldn't have believed you, because I had that
prejudice that you had kind of ingrained. Yeah.
Yeah. And as time went by, you know, I just kept reconciling the fact, okay, why would God, right, you know, why would God make a different race that should be subjugated by another race? Mm-hmm. I just have a hard time believing that he would do that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Jesus wasn't about conquest. Jesus wasn't about power. Jesus was about love. Mm-hmm. And, you know, his stories are, you know, how could I be a Christian and be prejudiced? I found that I had to choose mm-hmm. between the two.
Yeah.
And so I made that choice. The Black Lives Matter thing, I can't really understand their anger. I can somewhat empathize with it. I can say I understand it, mm-hmm. but I really can't, because it's never happened to me.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I did have a couple of incidents in other countries, but they were minor
compared to that, yeah.
grief, compared with what it must be like to grow up with that, and everything. So, the video of what that police officer did to George Floyd just angered me, saddened me. Mm-hmm. It was so shocking. And if I had been in a culture that I would see so much of that, it would be very difficult.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then again, you know, I hate the fact that a few of these turned into violent protests.
Yeah, that just seems like it's going back the other way and perpetuating the cycle to some extent. So
yeah.
Well, Kirk, I appreciate this time to speak. This has been a good conversation, I'm glad we got to have this.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to meet you, Tim. And you know, we live in the same town. I'd love to get to know you and your family a little bit more and everything. Perhaps we could meet for a cup of coffee, or better yet, a beer.
Yeah, that would be great. We should do that sometime. Okay, well, thanks.